And we are rolling. Hi, Gregory.
Hi.
This is Mark Goldberg with the UN and Global Affairs blog, UN Dispatch, speaking with Gregory Johnson, a PhD candidate at Princeton University. And Gregory, you are a bona fide Yemen expert, a hot commodity these days. So unfortunately, this is going to be a limited chat. You have to get going for another interview in about 20 minutes, but hopefully in that time we can, get as deep as we can into these issues. Now, Gregory, as it happened, I scheduled an interview with you, before Yemen was hot in the news, well before the Christmas Day bombing attempt. And the reason I wanted to talk to you about Yemen is because it had sort of percolated in my UN news sphere as the place of a big humanitarian crisis. Now, that humanitarian crisis is something I'd like to get into a little later, but, first, I just Yemen obviously has been front page news for the last couple of weeks, and I can only imagine, as a Yemen expert, you have seen things in the media that sort of make your head scratch, that make you, slap your forehead. And I'm wondering if you can kind of go down the list of sort of improper themes or unfull descriptions of the conflict in Yemen or Yemen in general and sort of what you see as sort of perceived media offenses so far.
Yeah, well, there are a number, and of course, different times I feel like my ears are bleeding or I want to rip my eyes out of my head, but such is sort of the nature of the game. I think there are a few sort of journalistic cliches that get bandied about by people without a great deal of experience in the country. So one of the things that you often see referenced in the media are things like Yemen is Osama bin Laden's ancestral homeland, as if that were something that sort of explained all of Yemen without actually having to go there or do any research there. I would point out that Robert Wirth of the New York Times a few months ago wrote a really, really excellent article on this, debunking this myth. There's no evidence whatsoever that Osama bin Laden ever spent any time in Yemen. His father was certainly from there, but his father made his fortune in Saudi Arabia, and Osama bin Laden was shaped by his experience in Saudi Arabia. Certainly bin Laden has many times referred to Yemen, as have numerous other jihadis, but this is, I think it's misleading and disingenuous to refer to Yemen this way. Mm-hmm. Another thing I think that gets sort of bandied about is that guns outnumber people in Yemen 3-1. And there's been a number of surveys done, well, not a number, but one very good survey done by Derek Miller, which I think actually gets at really the roots of the arm trade within Yemen, dealing with how many actual weapons there are. And I think this is something that should be required reading. Mm-hmm. Another one I think that gets talked about is that the Yemeni government doesn't really have any control outside of the capital. And this isn't quite accurate. The Yemeni government does have some control. It is able to affect change in certain areas. Certainly in some areas, it's able to affect much greater change than in other areas. But when it wants to, it can even go into the tribal regions and carry out different agreements with the sheikhs. It can do different things there that at least according to the media portrayal, it often isn't able to do. Another issue that I often have, and this is something that at different times some of the things that I've written have been guilty of this, so this is something I need to be careful of.
Fair enough.
And that's referring to some of the spaces in Yemen as ungoverned or undergoverned spaces. And I think this really misses the issue because it's not as if there's no rule or no order in these spaces. There certainly is. It's just not a rule or order that's imposed by the central government. Mm-hmm. It's what's in Yemen known oftentimes, particularly in the north and particularly in tribal regions, as urf, which is this sort of tribal or customary law. And so I think it's a bit of a shorthand, and this idea that Yemen is this wild, wild west sort of Indian country outside of Sana'a, something where anything and everything can happen. It's completely chaotic. That is also misleading. Mm-hmm. Now, to get into Yemen as sort of in a general overview, I think it's very easy when when thinking about Yemen to become overwhelmed by sort of the totality of the crises that the country is facing. Mm-hmm. So I tend to think of these in sort of three distinct layers, if you will. So at the top, you have this elite rivalry that's largely taking place behind closed doors, out of sight. This is something where individuals within the president's family are really attempting to position themselves to take up power once he departs the scene. Mm-hmm. There's also numerous other very powerful tribal business families that are trying to turn their political clout into muscle as well. Mm-hmm. Below this level, and that's a very, I think, important level up at the top, even though outsiders like ourselves, we don't know a great deal about it. There are a lot of palace intrigue, many different rumors. It's very Byzantine, if you will. But still, this, I think, is very, very important. And from time to time, we get sort of some of the reverberations, if you will, of what's taking place there. Mm-hmm. Below this, in the second layer, are these trio of security crises that I think most people who have come to Yemen in the last little bit know something about. This is the Houthi insurgency in the north, this civil war, which I think is what drew your interest initially. This is part of the major humanitarian crises in Yemen. Mm-hmm. And then there's, of course, the increasingly violent calls for secession from the south, as well as a resurgent al-Qaeda threat. And so these are this middle layer is really what I think grabs the lion's share of the headlines. Mm-hmm. Below this, we have what I would call foundational challenges to the state. These are things like the state is running out of water. The state is losing money, and it's mm-hmm. losing money through a loss of oil exports. Mm-hmm. There's rampant corruption within the government. Illiteracy rates are incredibly high. Education is very low and inadequate in most places. Mm-hmm. There's an antiquated infrastructure in the country that's crumbling. Poverty is very high. Mm-hmm. There are really just a laundry list of problems with Yemen. And so that tends to be how I think of Yemen, sort of in an overview. And one of the important things to realize about these sort of three different strata, if you will, is that they all exacerbate and play off of each other. So al-Qaeda takes advantage of the civil war in the north and the calls for secession from the mm-hmm. south by, you know, the Yemeni military is active in both places, and so then it has less attention to put towards al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. Some of these insurgencies have sprouted up because the country's losing money, and when Yemen loses money, it's like throwing sand in the machine. The traditional way that President Saleh has attempted to govern is no longer sustainable because he's often attempted to govern by playing different opposition groups off against one another, and this is no longer sustainable when he no longer has the money to do it.
So that, I mean, I think what you just explained seems to be a really important way, a really important framework, I guess, to understand the sort of panoply and of conflicts in Yemen. Although, you know, again, in the media, you see a lot of it seems that there are comparisons that some pundits draw to Afghanistan and Pakistan. And I'm wondering, do you see any utility in those comparisons, or is there mostly sort of peril when you go down that path?
Yeah, at sort of a surface level, I think there is some use to those, just because most people in the West, most people who are sort of consuming this news, don't have a very good understanding of many of these countries. And so there are some similarities, and there, I think in order to understand things, one has to generalize, one has to be able to compare, and this mm-hmm. is important. But it's also important to realize that each country is unique, although I don't believe Yemen is exceptional, if you get the distinction there. I would say I don't think Yemen is, say, the next Afghanistan. Certainly, and this is not something that only the English language press is guilty of. Mm-hmm. It's also something that you see quite often in the Arabic press. There was a very detailed three-part report by a Lebanese journalist, Hazem Al-Amin, in Al-Hayat back in December of 2005, and he spent a lot of time on the comparisons between Afghanistan and Yemen, talking about the tribes in both places, the mm-hmm. mountainous, rugged country in both places. And this is true, again, to a certain extent, but when you get below sort of this surface layer, you see many, many differences, which I think are important to take into account. For instance, Yemen doesn't have sort of this history of warlordisms that we've seen in Afghanistan. Yemen has a functioning government to a degree that Afghanistan hasn't known in the last few decades. There's not this recent history of warfare. There's not sort of the ethnic divisions in Yemen that we see in Afghanistan. So there are a number of important distinctions when you compare Yemen to, say, Afghanistan or even to Somalia. And I think that that sort of determines, or at least for me, that suggests that Yemen's future will be much different than that of Afghanistan or Somalia, that if you sort of play it down the road a little bit, that Yemen isn't going to necessarily look like Afghanistan or look like Somalia. That doesn't mean that Yemen is going to look good. It just means that the problems in Yemen are going to look different than the problems in Afghanistan and in Somalia.
And we are re-recording. Hi, Gregory.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So as viewers might notice, we are wearing different clothing. We had a slight technical issue with our first with recording this the first time around. So we're just going to pick up where we left off. We're recording this now 2 days later. But, you know, Yemen still exists. The conflict is still there. And Gregory has been exploding in the mainstream media in the days since. But Gregory, thanks again for re-recording this and for kind of picking up where we left off. So as I asked you, the reason I originally sort of reached out to you before Christmas was that, you know, I read a blog about the UN and global affairs, and I had seen these reports coming out from UN humanitarian agencies about this growing humanitarian crisis in North Yemen. I remember reading that in sort of late fall that the population of the largest IDP camp in Yemen sort of doubled basically overnight. So I wanted to ask you to sort of explain the roots of that humanitarian crisis and the roots of the Houthi rebellion in northern Yemen. So take it away, Gregory.
Right, and thanks again, and I apologize for some of the recording difficulties, which were on my end. I think the best way to sort of talk about the Houthi conflict is to take sort of a broad view of Yemeni history. And so as some of your viewers, I'm sure, are well aware, there was a civil war in Yemen that broke out in 1962, really a palace coup that turned into a civil war. And this went on for about 8 years, really ending in 1970. And at different times, the British were involved in the civil war. Gamal Abdel Nasser from Egypt was involved. The Saudis were involved. And this was the civil war overthrew what was called the Imamate and established a republican rule in Yemen. And the Imamate was a Zaydi political religious office that had been in Yemen since about 893, when the first in different forms since 893, when the first Imam of Yemen, Yahya bin Hussein, came to Yemen. And so North Yemen has been Zaydi, which is a sect of Shiism, but it's much different than the type of Shiism that many of us in the West are familiar with that's practiced in, say, Iran or Iraq. That is known as 12er Shiism. Zaydis are 5er Shia. And so actually in Yemen, the Zaydis are considered to be much closer to Sunni Islam than they are to their Shia brethren, if you will, throughout the Arab and Middle Eastern worlds. So after the civil war, the Republican government has always sort of been a little wary about this northern government up in the north, this region of Sa'dah. And the reason for that is that this has always been sort of the stronghold for Zaydi purists, if you will. That is where the Imam, who when he retreated from Sana'a, that's where he went. He established his headquarters there. That was really strong point throughout the civil war. So the individuals up in Sa'dah always felt as though they never really capitalized on some of the promises that were made to them by the Republican government. And in fact, one of the things that you hear now is that the government only ever built one hospital up in Sa'dah. During the 1980s and 1990s, these Zaidi purists up in Saada felt as though their cultural heritage was really being eroded and that they were in danger of extinction by what they thought was this two-pronged alliance. This was the government and sort of a Wahhabi influenced organization and individuals there who were working at doing things such as converting the youth of Saada, turning them away from traditional Zaidism towards Wahhabism. These Wahhabi converts would destroy many of the graves, many of the tombs up there. So there was a great article written by a couple of Western academics in the Middle East Report that's titled "The Clash of Fundamentalism," which details this conflict up there. A professor at Princeton, Bernard Haeckel, also wrote about this in the mid-1990s. And both of these reports and these articles really get at what the roots of this Houthi conflict were. And the Houthis at different times, what's known as the Houthis today anyways, they also took money from the government. So this is something where President Ali Abdullah Saleh has always tended to sort of rule by playing different opposition groups off against one another in an attempt to sort of keep them all perpetually dependent upon him. And so at different times when he felt that the Houthis or the Zaidi purists were too strong, he would support the Wahhabis, and this was usually the case, but there were times that he also supported the Zaidis in the north. And it should be noted that President Saleh himself is a Zaidi. He has Zaidi heritage. The difference is that he's not a Hashemi. And so if Yemen were still being run along sort of Zaidi theological doctrine, President Saleh would be ineligible to rule because he doesn't meet some of the 14 points that are required to be an imam according to the Zaidi tradition, whereas the Houthi family does meet those points, and so they would be eligible. So this is something that the president, given sort of the historical memory of Zaidi rule within Yemen, has always been a little bit sensitive about. The revolt itself really started in 2004 when a former member of parliament, Hussein Badruddin, evaded arrest by the Yemeni government. His followers, who he had sort of been teaching for a number of years, he had helped them out with theological training, also given them sort of some military training to sort of combat the Wahhabis. And throughout the 1980s and 1990s, as I mentioned, there were a number of different clashes going back and forth between the Zaidi purists in the north and the Wahhabis up there. And this really spilled over in 2004. And the government went in, it tried to arrest him, and then it sort of got in a little bit over its head, I think, at least. And we had a very sort of brutal round of fighting that ended in September of 2004 when Hussein was killed by the Yemeni government. But that did not put down the rebellion. This is something that we're now in what's often called, at least in the Arabic press, the sixth round of conflict. And this is one that is one of the most vicious rounds that we've seen since the sort of overt fighting began in 2004. Saudi Arabia has been involved in this now since November. The Yemeni government is increasingly unable to put down the threat there. And it's something that, as the war has went along, it's really taken on a logic all its own. That is, government mismanagement of the war has sort of drawn in a number of tribes into the conflict where not necessarily out of any ideological loyalty to the Houthis, but rather because the government destroyed their lands or destroyed their crops or killed someone in their village. And so you have this incredibly now murky and multifaceted conflict that's going on a number of different levels. And so it's not clear if sort of Abdul Malik al-Houthi, one of the younger brothers of Hussein, who's currently leading the Houthis, really has control over all the fighters up there or not. Another thing that makes this conflict so intractable is that members on both sides, both on the Houthis as well as the government side, if you can even talk about it as a two-sided conflict, which I think is slightly misleading, but for our purposes might work. But members on both of these sides are benefiting greatly from the war economy that's going on and making money and making a lot of it.
Can I ask you, what are Saudi's interests in sort of seemingly joining with the Yemeni government in trying to suppress the Houthis? I'd seen reports that they, you know, launched military strikes against the Houthi rebels.
Right. So this is a very complicated question, but a very important one. In my view, I think that Saudi Arabia is the most important actor within Yemen. It has a very complicated relationship with Yemen. So if you compare, say, Saudi Arabia to the U.S., then you really see the differences. So the U.S. is focused almost exclusively on al-Qaeda in Yemen, whereas Saudi Arabia, given its geographical proximity to Yemen, is really focused on a number of different issues. So Mohammed bin Nayef, the Saudi's counterterrorism chief, really heads sort of the al-Qaeda part of Saudi Arabia's portfolio to Yemen. But it's unclear whether there's one individual who's really running Saudi policy towards Yemen, as opposed to just a series of individuals who have little chunks of the portfolio. It used to be that a man, a prince, now Crown Prince Sultan, was running the kingdom's portfolio to Yemen, but he's been sick for a number of years, and his council, as well as him, I never really thought had a great understanding of Yemen. That is, Saudi Arabia put a great deal of money into Yemen, most of it bypassing the central government and going towards tribal friends. I think it'd be too much to call them clients. But Saudi Arabia never really seemed to get a great return on the money that it poured into Yemen. So their active conflict in the north started in November when a number of Houthis or Houthi fighters sort of went across the border. Now, it's a very complicated sort of issue here, but essentially the Houthis claim that a month earlier the Yemeni government had went into Saudi territory and sort of used Saudi territory to carry out some flanking maneuvers against Houthi positions. They said at the time that they warned the Saudi government not to allow the Yemenis to do that. And since the beginning of the conflict, the Saudis have often been involved sort of helping the Yemeni government, supporting the Yemeni government. In fact, in 2008, they tried to get Hussein al-Ahmar, a son of a very prominent sheikh who's now passed away, in Yemen to sort of lead a tribal militia against the Houthis. So they've certainly been against the Houthis from the beginning. But in November, the Houthis claimed that the Yemeni government, for a second time, used Saudi territory to carry out some flanking maneuvers, and they retaliated by going across the border and striking at those Yemeni government military positions. The Saudis then used their incursions across the border as a pretext to then carry out raids. And since then, Saudi Arabia has been very actively involved in the conflict, a conflict that it doesn't quite seem to understand that well. And my belief is that Saudi involvement in the conflict will do much more to sort of expand and extend the war than it will to limit the war itself.
And can I ask you, so if President Obama called you up tomorrow and invited you to participate in a meeting of the National Security Council and said, you know, Gregory Johnson, what's your advice? What should we do? What should U.S. policy be? What would you advise?
Leaving aside the sort of fanciful nature of that scenario, but towards the Houthi conflict in particular,
towards U.S. policy towards Yemen, which as you seem to suggest, also would include sort of a reworking, I guess, of America's bilateral relationship with Saudi Arabia as well. But in general, if you know Obama, you know, is having a National Security Council meeting on Yemen and wanted some outside advice, what would you give him?
Well, I think one of the things is that the U.S. has to realize what its influence and what its leverage is in Yemen. So I don't think that the United States' impressions of its own leverage always square with reality. That is, I think the U.S. tends to believe that it has more influence in Yemen than it actually does. But the U.S. does have a significant influence, I think, with Saudi Arabia, and the U.S. has particular points in Yemen where it can influence policy. Now, I was in Yemen in July and August of 2009, and I spent a great deal of time talking to people from many different segments of society, some that I've known for a number of years, others that I just met on this trip. And one of the things that I was really struck with then, as I am now, is that there really is no military solution to the conflict in the north. I mean, all of the crises, all of the challenges that the Yemeni government is facing really play off of and exacerbate each other. So when you look at the conflict in the north, this is something that has been sort of off and on for a number of years, since June of 2004. The Yemeni government recently has felt as though its inability to really militarily put down this conflict has emboldened calls for secession in the south. So you see the playoff. You see how what people in the West often see as sort of individual crises are all sort of lumped together by the Yemeni government itself and thought of in sort of a coherent package, if you will. And so the Yemeni government feels that by carrying out a very strong reaction against the Houthis in the north, they will also send a very strong signal to the south. But by their inability to put this down, they're also sending a signal to the south. I believe that there's no military solution to the conflict in the north, that this has to be something that's a political solution that can be worked out. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the Houthis have claimed on any number of occasions that they're ready to deal. The Yemeni government often puts preconditions to these talks that are really non-starters for the Houthis. But I think if the U.S. were to get serious and tell Saudi Arabia to knock it off in the north, tell Yemen to knock it off, that the significant process could be made on this front. And I think that if the U.S. wants to go after al-Qaeda in Yemen, if it wants to make that a priority, then it has to deal with some of these other issues, or at least be involved in dealing with some of these other issues. Not that the U.S. has to take the lead on every single problem within Yemen, but the U.S. needs to, I think, partner with a number of other countries and have some sort of coordinated approach to Yemen. But you certainly, I don't think, will ever be able to deal with the al-Qaeda conflict to really eradicate al-Qaeda in Yemen without dealing with some of these other issues. Al-Qaeda really feeds off the chaos within Yemen. And I've argued that you should first, I think, solve the Houthi conflict before you start going after some of these others, because if you don't, then I don't see any counterterrorism or any attempts to sort of eradicate al-Qaeda in Yemen as being successful.
Mm-hmm. And can I ask you maybe one final question, similar to the last one I asked you? You know, I write the UN focused blog, and I'm wondering, is there anything in particular that the UN is doing, should be doing, could be doing that might that might help the situation in any way in Yemen? Be that as like the UN's role as a convener, or the UN's role as sort of on the ground development assistance manager. Mm-hmm. Is there anything? Go ahead.
Well, I think the UN has at different times played a significant role, and I think that the U.S. has been a positive force there. For instance, it was a few months ago, it was, I think, September or October, the Yemeni government accidentally, or inadvertently bombed a number of fleeing refugees. And these refugees were actually allied with a tribe that was fighting with the Yemeni government against the Houthis. And so clearly it wasn't an intentional bombing. But the UN made a very strong statement and essentially told President Saleh and the Yemeni government to knock it off. And the Yemeni government, they took that quite seriously. And for a number of days, they did stop. There was no follow through from any other international partner. Excuse me, whether the UN or the US or anyone else following it up. So then the Yemeni government felt as though they were still able to sort of, go forward and prosecute the war as they had been in the past. But certainly the Yemeni government is, I think, sensitive to criticism and strongly worded criticism from either the UN, the EU, the US, other international partners. This is something that they are sensitive to. The UN, of course, can do a great deal of work. The humanitarian crisis there is something that I think you're absolutely spot on. It hasn't been covered very well, and it is a crisis that is can be quite dangerous, I think. I mean, you have a number of internally displaced people within the country. Who knows, when you get into these camps, what is sort of going on within these camps, whether you have crossover from all sorts of different groups that you'd really not like to be mixing together. And the results of that, I think, can be rather combustible.
Great. Well, thank you for that. If you have any parting thoughts, I'll let you. I'll give you the floor if there's anything else we missed that you think we ought to cover.
Well, I think the thing that I would like to say is that it's really easy to become depressed when talking about Yemen, which is very unfortunate for individuals like myself who consider themselves to be academics who want to make a career out of traveling to Yemen, have a number of Yemeni friends, love the culture, love the history of Yemen. It really is easy to get depressed, and it's easy to become overwhelmed when thinking about sort of the totality of the challenges that face Yemen, that face President Saleh, that face the government today, and really struggling to sort of see your way out. And I had a conversation with a presidential advisor, a Yemeni presidential advisor, the last time I was in the country, and he pointed me towards an Arabic book, essentially a chronicle of the 18th century, and he was essentially making the comparison that, look, Yemen has seen far worse than we're in today, and survived. And I think that opinion, and the opinion of a number of other foreign experts, individuals that I personally have a great deal of respect for their opinion, say the same thing, that look, Yemen will be able to muddle through these challenges. It just sort of bounces around. Sarah Phillips, an Australian academic, I think has a great phrase calling the Yemeni government sort of a government of crisis management, which I think is a spectacular way to put it, in a very accurate way. But I think this idea that Yemen will sort of muddle through from crisis to crisis, challenge to challenge, I think this tends to confuse history with analysis. And I would argue that hope in the Yemeni case, hope that they'll survive, hope that they'll continue to go along, isn't really a strategy. And that if you don't develop some sort of a strategy to deal with these challenges, then you're going to be in a great deal of trouble in the future.
Gregory, thank you so much. And, you know, stay on it. I'm sure I'll see you on various sort of television outlets and radio outlets as, you know, we all try to become more informed about this topic. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.